Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, we're back in the studio. We are together.
Yes, together again.
Just in time to spend some time talking about Afghanistan.
I have the grimmest podcast we've ever recorded.
Yes, it has been a momentous and awful week there. And we figured, let's just dedicate the entire show to what's happened over the past week. Really what's happened over the past 20 years. Try to get it to all the context here. Because look, there's some big things happening. Like this earthquake in Haiti is heartbreaking. And it's something we should keep an eye on. But I think the whole world's eyes are on Afghanistan right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, and Haiti is something that will require, you know, extended attention. And I saw Samantha Powers very much on this. But yeah, right now, I think it's impossible to focus on anything but Afghanistan. And it's actually one of those times where I'm glad that there's a podcast where we can actually, you know, even in an hour, you can barely scratch the surface of the context here. But you can do a little bit more than you can on a cable.
Yeah, it's weird that Twitter's not cutting it.
Twitter is not the right genre for this one.
Before we get to the news, I just want to make sure everybody knows that we are back with a brand new season of This Land. Host Rebecca Nagel, she's taking you inside her year-long investigation into a series of custody battles over Native American children and how the most powerful people on the far right wing are using them to quietly dismantle American Indian tribes and advance a conservative agenda. This Land's new trailer is out now. The first two episodes premiere on August 23rd. Listen, subscribe to This Land wherever your podcast. The first season was incredible. It won journalism awards. Rebecca's done an amazing job with season two. So please check it out. So Ben, I'm going to try to do like a quick catch up on what's happened over the last week, and then we get to Biden's speech. So in the last week, the Taliban took control over basically all of Afghanistan, including Kabul, the capital city. Much of this takeover happened without fighting between Afghan security forces and the Taliban. It was more of a ceasefire or surrender by the Afghan government forces, and we'll get into why later. Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, fled to Tajikistan on Sunday. I think a lot of his ministers came with him. Ghani released a statement on Facebook saying the Taliban have won the battle of sword and guns, and now they are responsible for protecting the countrymen's honor, wealth, and dignity, end quote. So now we have Taliban soldiers, fighters policing the streets in Kabul. There's these surreal videos of Taliban fighters like wandering around the presidential palace, going on rides at amusement parks. There was a video of some guys using a weight room for some fucking reason. U.S. embassy staff have been evacuated to the airport. President Biden had to send thousands of troops back into Afghanistan to secure the airport. For a while, that airport was just total chaos. There were thousands of people desperately trying to get on flights out of the country as the Taliban were rolling in. President Biden gave a speech. We'll talk about that in a minute. On Tuesday, the Taliban spokesman gave a press conference where he said the Taliban would respect the rights of women and minorities and protect foreigners. I think history should make us quite skeptical of those assurances. The Taliban spokesman also complained about Facebook. So we have got that in common with them, I guess. The Department of Defense estimated that there could be between 5,000 and 10,000 Americans left in Afghanistan. There's tens of thousands more Afghan citizens and their families who worked with the U.S. in some capacity who are trying to get out of the country. The Biden administration says they're now in control of the airport and hopefully can fly these people out. But the problem is that a lot of Afghans can't get to the airport without going through Taliban checkpoints. So they're still in some serious danger. In some cases, you're seeing, as a result, basically empty evacuation flights. So that's the latest. So let's start with Biden's speech from Monday, and we'll roll some clips here. So it was a pretty defiant speech defending his decision. Biden talked about the success the U.S. had degrading al-Qaeda in the region, killing bin Laden, his long-held opposition to expanding the U.S. mission to include a broader nation-building effort. And he also made clear that Biden believes the primary responsibility for the military defeat lies with the Afghan government and forces. Let's hear a clip.
American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves. We spent over $1 trillion. We trained and equipped an Afghan military force with some 300,000 strong, incredibly well equipped, a force larger in size than the militaries of many of our NATO allies. We gave them every tool they could need. We paid their salaries, provided for the maintenance of their Air Force, something the Taliban doesn't have. Taliban does not have an Air Force. We provided close air support. We gave them every chance to determine their own future. We could not provide them was the will to fight for that future.
Biden also had some harsh words for Afghanistan's political leaders. So we'll listen to that clip and then we'll talk about it.
When I hosted President Ghani and Chairman Abdullah at the White House in June, and again when I spoke by phone to Ghani in July, we had very frank conversations. We talked about how Afghanistan should prepare to fight their civil wars after the U.S. military departed, to clean up the corruption in government so the government could function for the Afghan people. We talked extensively about the need for Afghan leaders to unite politically. They failed to do any of that. I also urged them to engage in diplomacy, to seek a political settlement with the Taliban. This advice was flatly refused. Mr. Ghani insisted that the Afghan forces would fight. But obviously, he was wrong.
So, Ben, some listeners were upset by Biden's blunt criticism of the Afghan military in particular, probably less so of the government. I think I understand the point he's trying to make here. I mean, you know, again, like these, a lot of these peace deals were cut between Afghan forces and the Taliban. We'll get into why later. I also understand how people listening might find this insulting to the tens of thousands of Afghan soldiers, police, many, many more civilians who've been killed over the years. But what did you make of that pointed criticism and the speech generally?
I think the speech generally encompassed, you know, basically his best case, which was, you know, Joe Biden has not believed that the United States was capable or should carry out a nation-building exercise in Afghanistan, that 20 years into that effort, the idea that we would stay for another year or 5 years and make a difference in what was already a deteriorating situation, you know, he just didn't believe that that was feasible or possible. And therefore, you know, you have to end this war at some point, and he decided that this is the time. And I think that, you know, that's a very credible argument to make. I think that the clips we heard, there's a couple of problems with them. One is, just as you said, that there was a kind of noticeable lack of empathy. The Afghan security forces have lost over 60,000 people fighting the Taliban. They've been fighting them for years. He almost made it sound like we've been doing the fighting and now we left and then they just refused to fight. Actually, they've been in the lead here since
like 2014,
and they've taken a lot of casualties, right? And so a lot of people were willing to fight. And that leads to the second point, which is, you know, he kept saying, and you've heard other administrations officials say, that they lack the will. And there may be a political point to that that I'll get to in a second, but well, really, they lack the capability. And that's as much an indictment of our policy over 20 years. Because essentially what we did is we built, yes, a 300,000-strong Afghan security force that was also entirely dependent on not just the U.S. military, but contractors, U.S. military contractors, for things like, you know, intelligence. How do you manage that close air support? I mean, picture a machine that is built to function plugged into another machine.
Yeah.
And then you just remove that machine and they weren't prepared to...
Logistics, communications, like the dudes who twist the wrench to fix the helicopter, like half of them left between April and June of this year.
That's exactly right. Like they have the equipment, they have guns, but like all the things that allow a military to move around, to know where the enemy is, to coordinate air support of people on the ground, like those functions disappeared, you know, over the course of this withdrawal. And so his basic point, I think, is one that resonates with Americans, which is that, like, at a certain point, we can't fight in another country's civil war. And I think that's a credible argument to make after 20 years. I do think it was a little it just went over its skis, I think, to some extent, in pinning this on some of the Afghans themselves. I think the Afghan political leadership, look, I think, first of all, there is a question as they folded so fast that it did feel like some deals had been cut.
Yeah, and yeah. I want to talk about that in detail later, because there's a really good Washington Post report about these deals. I feel like we're just like kind of at the tip of the iceberg with that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, basically, you know, had the Taliban either infiltrated or cut all these deals with, you know, military commanders or people out in regional governments. And to some extent, you know, that is an indictment of Ashraf Ghani and the Afghan government just kind of being in Kabul and having very little, you know, connection down to their own security forces and their own more localized officials. And so the, you know, the pointed criticism of Ghani, again, you could make the same argument that, you know, Ghani is kind of the type of official who was hugely dependent on the U.S. But it is the case that over successive Afghan governments, there have been these problems around, you know, trying to centralize authority and not being able to do that. Obviously, there's been endemic corruption. Again, I would argue, too, that while that is absolutely the case, and you saw some of these extraordinary videos, I think, that the Taliban posted of the lavish compounds that these like warlords lived in.
Right.
Look, there's corruption on our side, too, right? In the sense that, you know, people ask that where a lot of that money went, the trillions of dollars. Like, well, a lot of it went to U.S. military contractors. You know, there was a whole kind of war economy that was built that didn't really reach down to people. And look, I was a part of an administration for 8 years that you know was a part of a policy of trying to build these Afghan security forces and try to support this Afghan government. So to me, he's definitely correct in his indictment of Afghan political leadership. I think the reality is all of us who were a part of this policy under four administrations was also a part of a policy approach of that just didn't work. The idea, like, we could go, here's my core point, Tommy, is like, we can go and kill terrorists. We can go and blow things up. Like, that's what our military is built to do. That part of the Afghanistan project, you know, did generally succeed if you look at the degradation of Al-Qaeda. But our capacity, this other part of the policy of like kind of building up Afghan institutions, Afghan security forces and handing it off to them, well, clearly, you know, clearly that did not work.
Yeah. And we're going to dig into the history of how that mission sort of creeped and evolved over time later in the show. So Biden also explained sort of like the more acute question I think a lot of people are having, which is why didn't the U.S. evacuate more Afghans earlier? How is there this like mad rush at the end? So here's a clip of that.
I know there are concerns about why we did not begin evacuating Afghans, civilians sooner. Part of the answer is some of the Afghans did not want to leave earlier, still hopeful for their country. And part of it because the Afghan government and its supporters discouraged us from organizing a mass exodus to avoid triggering, as they said, a crisis of confidence.
So I found the first part of that argument that Afghans didn't want to be evacuated sooner to be kind of odd and bullshit. I mean, maybe there are some individuals who didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there are tens of thousands who have been trying to leave for a long time. So setting that aside, I'm sure the point about the Afghan government not wanting the U.S. to make it look like we're getting everybody out in some rushed manner is true. And it kind of speaks to the fundamental challenge Biden had with his decision generally, right? Like the international community spent two decades trying to build up the Afghan military and the government with this goal of that being our exit strategy, right? We hand over responsibility to the Afghans, to their military, and we leave. But once you set a date to get out, the Biden choice becomes rush people out and maybe look like you have no confidence in the Afghan government or withdraw troops, hand over responsibility, hope it all works. Clearly, in hindsight, they made the wrong decision. You know, they did the hope that it works play. And like, you know, even with making that decision, like the visa process could have and should have been accelerated. And then maybe your break glass option is you push the withdrawal deadline out 6 months or something to get more people out. But like, what do you make of this argument, Ben, that like the evacuations didn't start earlier because of the Afghan government?
To me, this is the biggest problem with this whole withdrawal is what happened to the Afghans and the failure to evacuate them. Like that's the thing that I think is hard to excuse. And I'd break it into to a couple different issues. One is this SIV issue, right? This is the special visa for Afghan interpreters, people who worked with our military, mm-hmm. which is an existing program. And they were, you know, Biden in his speech was saying, well, we've gotten 2,000 of these people out. And it's
nothing.
Like, that is a drop in the ocean. I mean, we're talking 50, 60,000 people at least, you know, who are in that kind of danger. And to me, like, what I cannot understand is what he said about people not wanting to leave, or what he said about the Afghan government not wanting mass exodus. Okay, there, I can see the point about the Afghan government not wanting mass exodus, but just dramatically ramping up that SIV program would not necessarily be a mass exodus where we're saying, like, everybody get out, everybody get on C-17s.
Right.
And clearly they were still operating within the confines of the existing bureaucracy of the program. There are caps on who can come. There are all these requirements, all these forms, all these hurdles that people have to jump over.
Interviews.
And I don't know why from the moment that he announced the withdrawal, it wasn't like, that's all gone. And we talked on the show, like, we don't even necessarily need to fly all those people to the U.S. They could fly them to other U.S. military installations. They can take them to Guam. They can cut a deal with a Central Asian country to have a facility there. The SIV program and the failure to just dramatically ramp that up and get into the tens of thousands at least by this time, I truly don't understand it, because I don't think that ramping up that program would have been the kind of mass exodus that is described. Yeah. Now, the second point is another thing that has concerned me, is that until basically the last couple of days, they were not allowing for people like USAID subcontractors, like people who got USAID grants, mm-hmm. those types of people.
The P2 visas, priority.
The P2 visas. Yeah. And just to give people a sense of this, like, what if the U.S. government, like, gives a grant to somebody to set up an organization to promote girls' education, or to catalog human rights abuses, or to do things that you know the Taliban finds offensive and has in the past killed people for doing those things.
Yep.
If we subsidize them doing that, how are they not just as at risk and just as worthy of evacuation as someone who's a military interpreter?
Right.
And these are a lot of the people I know, you know, I've been hearing from Afghans on the ground, Afghans in other countries, desperately trying to get these people out. These people want to leave. So I don't understand the argument that, I'm sure anecdotally there were some Afghans who were like, I want to stay. I even know some Afghans who, I don't know if they wanted to stay, but like they were hoping for better than what happened.
Sure.
But I wanted to see both, like, that SIV program moving much faster, but then a much larger category of people can get out. They're there now. The question is, how many people can they get out in the coming days, which we can talk about. So you could sense, and I sense this in Tony Blinken's comments in recent weeks, that they did truly believe. I don't think it's spin. I think that they truly believed that there was a risk that if it was a mass evacuation, it would kind of precipitate the
right.
exact collapse that did happen. But they could kind of see that that was happening anyway. You yep. know, the writing's been on the wall here for a number of weeks.
Well, and that's the thing, right? I think, like, doing the right thing almost required the U.S. government to preemptively say, this effort has failed. The nation building part of this has failed. The government is not stable. It's not trusted. It's seen as corrupt. It's seen as illegitimate, and it's over. And I'm sure COVID was part of what slowed down the
yes.
SIV process. And you're also seeing this fight spill out into the press, where the State Department staff didn't want to evacuate and the Pentagon was pissed at them because they were saying, we got to get you out earlier because the logistics will get hard. Well, those things are directly tied to this visa processing issue, right? Because a lot of these State Department officials are trying to help Afghans get out of the country, and they want to stick around and do their jobs because they're, like, brave people who care about what they're doing for a living. But, you know, there's this push and pull, and it's really hard. We dealt with this a lot after Benghazi, when we were constantly looking at, like, what embassies are safe, what are secure, how can we keep people safe in, like, dangerous places like Pakistan?
Yeah, I mean, and I remember the frustration of the bureaucracy of these programs, because everybody's worried about making the mistake of letting in somebody who, you know, could—
One terrorist,
that's, right?
It's all post-9/11 hysteria.
But to me, the balance of risk shifted dramatically to just get these people out as soon as, you know, the withdrawal decision is made. And, you know, you have, like, this narrow window of time where you control things, and you have, like, you know, Kabul not under Taliban control, And I think just clearly not much was done with that. I mean, if 2,000 Afghans have gotten out, I think this entire year before the situation we're in now, those numbers, again, we're talking about 100,000 people, I think, who are at risk. And one way to just think about this, Tommy, is like, obviously the priority of the U.S. government is going to be American citizens, American diplomats, like you said, that kind of Benghazi effect of really being hyper-focused on that. But the distance between the lengths that we go to extract Americans and what's been done for Afghans who sacrificed a shit ton and whose lives are at in some ways much greater risk than those Americans, you know, because it's more likely, I think, that the Taliban goes around trying to kill and extract or put in prison or do whatever horrific thing they might do to Afghans than that they go hunting for Americans. Like, that's a very uncomfortable reality that we've all, I think, experienced the last few days.
Yeah. And look, you know, this decision to not get more Americans, State Department personnel out earlier could look worse and worse over time if the situation, the security situation gets hairier. But I totally agree with you that it seems already more likely that the Taliban are going to target Afghan citizens.
And I just want to say one thing, Tommy. Like, I know, and I won't even name any of these people because, like, you know, you don't want to put them in careers, but the types of people I know or I'm familiar with who are in these circumstances are people who've, like, built their whole lives around supporting what we said we were doing in Afghanistan. You know, people who studied in the United States so that they could go back and join the Afghan government or set up a civil society organization, or people who truly believed that Afghanistan's future was going to be determined by how it treated their women. So they were going to go out and build schools for Afghan girls. Like, you cannot overstate how much these people put themselves on the line for what we said we believed in for them, you know? And man, like, this is a shameful, shameful situation. And I don't say that to single out even just Biden on this one. We're all, everybody, every one of us who worked on this policy, you know, should think about that for as long as we're on Earth. But particularly, you know, I hope that whatever comes next in our foreign policy, you know, is more grounded in people like that. Like, people.
Well, let's just say grounded what's possible. I think the U.S., you know, often has, whether it's setting a red line, whether it's telling the Iraqi Kurds to rise up in the first Gulf War, right? Like, suggesting to others that we will be there for them at all times when it's not necessarily always possible. Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation. Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, you know, for many, many years now because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Listen, if you're listening to Pod Save the World, you need some therapy. If you're watching the events around the world that might freak you out, we've got this election coming down the pike. There's a lot of stuff that people are stressed about, that are anxious about, stuff that makes you lose sleep, and therapy can help. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/CrookedWorld. Go today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CrookedWorld. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, spoke at the White House briefing today, and I thought did, you know, a little better job than Biden of explaining the broader options available when it comes to Afghanistan. Let's hear that clip.
President Biden had to think about the human costs of the alternative path as well, which was to stay in the middle of a civil conflict in Afghanistan. There are those who argue that with 2,500 forces, the number of forces in country when President Biden took office, we could have sustained a stable, peaceful Afghanistan. That is simply wrong. The previous administration drew down from 15,000 troops to 2,500 troops. And even at 15,000, the Afghan government forces were losing ground. What has unfolded over the past month has proven decisively that it would have taken a significant American troop presence, multiple times greater than what President Biden was handed, to stop a Taliban onslaught. And we would have taken casualties. American men and women would have been fighting and dying once again in Afghanistan, and President Biden was not prepared to send additional forces or ask any American personnel to do that over the period ahead.
So this is a very important argument, I think, that is not breaking through. And it's not breaking through because I think the media doesn't want to believe it, but also because I think you have some charlatans out there like selling a lie, which is that Biden's options were not keep a few thousand troops in Afghanistan, and automatically life is better for the Afghan people. Human rights are protected.
Yeah.
Women and girls are protected. It was keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan or probably be forced to send more troops to Afghanistan, engage in heavy fighting, take casualties. And for the Afghan people, most of all, it means spending another year or two or three or four living in a civil war, right? And that's the trade-off, right? Like, you could get killed. Again, like, the visa issues, the criticism of the last few weeks, that is all absolutely real and fair. But Jake, I think, is right that these are the imperfect options Biden had. Like, staying in Afghanistan creates risk for Afghan civilians. Leaving Afghanistan creates risk for Afghan civilians. I don't know how to make this depressing context break through.
That's right. And it's the bottom line, which is that 2,500 troops, which is where it was, you know, because of what Trump had done.
Right.
2,500 troops in the context of a deal in which you've already cut a deal with the Taliban to leave. I've seen these people say, well, we could have just left those 2,500 troops and had this kind of, you know, status quo that was relatively stable. No. I mean, first of all, it was not relatively stable in the sense that the Taliban has been making gains steadily year after year after year, and they were doing that when there were more than 2,500 troops there.
Biden said they were stronger today than they were before 9/11.
Well, and clearly they are, given how they ran over the country.
Yeah.
And so, like, in order to stay, first of all, you are going to be in a civil war. You're going to be in the middle, because it has been a civil war in a way for 20 years, like ever since we went in, and even in some ways before that. And so either we were probably going to have to surge back up if we made the decision to stay. You know, 2,500 troops is not even enough to protect our own forces there. Like, so there would have had to be a plus up of forces, I think, in order to stay. And inevitably, it's not that we would have been taking enormous casualties, because we haven't been taking that many casualties for years, but you would have taken some. And not just that, you know, you would have still been in Afghanistan spending billions and billions of dollars and trying to tip the balance of a civil war that has been going in the wrong direction for for many years now. And so I think Jake did lay out very honestly, like, this is just a calculation that Biden made, which is that, like, we've been there 20 years. We've not found the formula that works. The formula that works is not going to be 2,500 troops there. And he made a determination that, given everything else we have to do in the world, given a desire to kind of put a period on, you know, an aspect of post 9/11 foreign policy, like, this is what this is the only option that we had to do that. Otherwise, we're deeper in Afghanistan with all the risks that go along with that. And I think that's, you know, people don't want to accept that logic, but that logic is clear. And you can argue that, you know what, it's worth, like, having a few more thousand troops in Afghanistan. It's worth billions and billions of dollars, and it's worth the occasional American casualty, and it's worth all the mm-hmm. bandwidth of the U.S. government that goes into this. And that's another thing. It's a lot of bandwidth in the U.S. government that is not doing other things because it's been fighting a war in Afghanistan for so long. But the idea that there was this status quo option, I mean, that is not right. I mean, that is not right. And Jake is right to point that out.
And then, you know, you raise this, you know, this broader question of, like, why did the Afghan security forces not fight? And it keeps getting reported on as an intelligence failure. And I'm not even sure that's the right terminology, but, like, trying to assess what happened. Like, you mentioned this logistics problem, right? The U.S. pulls out. The Afghan army is dependent on U.S. personnel to do logistics or contractors, and suddenly they're gone, and it's hard for these army forces to operate. I think that logistical challenge was compounded by the fact that Ashraf Ghani didn't want to pull back Afghan forces from remote areas that he probably should have retreated from because he didn't want to look like he was giving up parts of the country. But then they literally couldn't get those guys food, is from what I've read. And then the other part of this—
And they seem to not be paying salaries.
Yeah, and they weren't paying them.
If you see the reporting, like, and that may be corruption. Like, why are these guys are being asked to fight and they're not getting paid? And that merits further scrutiny.
Yeah, that's a big problem. Yeah. And then the other factor, so there's this really interesting Washington Post report that said that Afghan officials have been quietly surrendering to the Taliban since last year. And they said it started at low levels.
When the peace deal happened.
Right, when the peace deal happened. Yeah. Well, exactly, yeah. Right?
Peace deal, like, right, the you know, the Taliban deal.
The withdrawal deal.
Call it, the withdrawal deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically, you know, what it sounds like happened was these deals were getting cut at lower levels. And then as the Taliban advance accelerated and got momentum, these deals started getting cut by more and more senior Afghan government officials. And that's why you saw, you know, the Taliban just walk into Kabul without firing a shot. Like, one important caveat to this is that the Afghan commando units, their special forces, have been in, like, brutal combat for months in places like Kandahar.
Yeah. But the big deal that was cut was the Trump deal. And again, this isn't about politics. It's about facts. Like, Trump cuts a deal with the Taliban where he says, you know, essentially, we're going to leave if you don't shoot at us. And what happened was, yeah, they stopped shooting us, but they kept shooting at the Afghan security forces. And all the Afghan, you know, warlords or regional or tribal leaders are looking and reading the writing on the wall. This is even before Biden comes in. And they start cutting deals with the Taliban because they're literally cutting the same deal that Trump cut. You know, they're cutting a deal that says, like, don't shoot at us. And, you know, you guys can do what you want. And so the momentum of this thing was well underway by the time Biden made his decision. And that's just a fact that has to be a part of our reckoning with this.
Well, so yeah, I agree. Like, and again, I think it's quite clear from this conversation, and we'll get into the broader history in a second, that, like, four presidents are responsible for this outcome. But it's been frustrating to see Mike Pompeo and Trump and others try to take a victory lap on this, given their role. So just some context, Ben, that we should talk about. Like you just said, they cut this deal without the Afghan government, Trump and Pompeo, and invited the Taliban to Camp David. And then they attacked Biden when he took the withdrawal deadline from May 1st to August 31st. Yeah. They said, oh, Biden's going to stick around forever now. Trump forced the Afghan government to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, many of whom went right back to fighting. And then in 2018, they pushed Pakistan to release Mullah Baradar, one of the founders of the Taliban, who is now basically the de facto leader. The Trump administration did everything possible to prevent refugees from coming to the U.S., including these special immigrant visas for people who helped us, to the point where there was a lawsuit against the Trump administration. Yeah. And a judge ruled that they'd violated the law because they slowed down the process. And so we have to, you know, this context is relevant. And I also think we need to watch this refugee issue really closely, because Stephen Miller is already out there trying to demagogue Afghan refugees. And last night, Tucker Carlson on his show said, if history is any guide, and it's always a guide, we will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country. And over the next decade, that number may swell to the millions. So first we invade, and then we are invaded. That is some chilling, chilling shit from a bow-tied fascist fuck. So I don't know, like that. I just think that context is important.
No, I mean, there's so much like there. I mean, the deal cut without Ghani too, totally undercut him in the country, right? The U.S. government that has been the principal force in the country for 20 years cuts a deal with the Taliban that totally excludes the Afghan government. That was part of what cut the legs out from underneath Ghani, because then the Taliban starts cutting deals with these other officials. The strangulation of an already bureaucratic program in terms of refugee admissions just stops the already slow-moving gears here. I mean, and to fucking Tucker Carlson's point, the best thing that could happen to this country is to have 150,000 Afghan refugees come in. And you know what they're going to do? You know what's going to happen? They're going to start businesses. They're going to like run for elected office. They're going to make enormous contributions to this country. Like we will be better for having them. It's not like charity. Like we will be enriched by them. In the same way we're sitting here in California, like look at what the Vietnamese American community has done in this state. You know, these people, the lack of any sense of internal accountability on their behalf is so astonishing. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to Bush here in a second too. But like they literally cut the deal with these people. You have Mike Pompeo. They pressured Pakistan to release the guy who's now like basically the president of Afghanistan. I'm not formally recognizing it. Not that anyone cares what I think about that. But the guy that they've declared to be the president of Afghanistan. Right. And Mike Pompeo met with the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he goes.
They took a photo.
Meets the guy. And like if oh my God, if Barack Obama had done that. You know, I don't even know what the consequences would have been. But there's this kind of, because there was such a farcical nature to Trump, people didn't take seriously like agreements that were reached. Like, so for instance, also the withdrawal of U.S. contractors was part of the deal.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about the withdrawal of the U.S. military. They literally Taliban knew what bargain they were driving. They're like, don't just get out the military. You got to get out those contractors too, right? So like, this was set in motion in a way, and then Biden comes in, and yeah, Biden has had a long held view that he wanted out of Afghanistan, and so he took it, right?
Yeah.
And
in fairness, he didn't have to accept that deal.
He didn't.
They could have renegotiated it, but they decided on balance that the risk. It was the right thing to do.
They could have torn it up. They could have said, we don't abide by this deal. It's a piece of garbage. Yeah. And by the way, they would have been right in saying that the Taliban hasn't really abided by the spirit of this deal either, because there's supposed to be a ceasefire.
And that was a point you were making at the time,
when
you extended the deadline.
They could have said, we are extending this because the Taliban's not. So again, this doesn't mean that Biden didn't make the decision he did. It doesn't mean that Biden hasn't mismanaged aspects of the decision he has. It does mean that Trump set in motion a withdrawal that had a lot of momentum and had created a lot of ripple effects in Afghanistan by the time Biden came in. And it does mean that the argument that Jake laid out is true, that the current course was not like some sustainable status quo. It was either ramp back up and get back into the civil war or get out. And people can argue, that ramping up a little bit and keeping Bagram, that there was a limited option you could have done. But this is where things were.
Yeah. And look, I don't think either of us opposed having peace talks with the Taliban. They should have included the Afghan government. That was like the original sin.
This too. I mean, and throughout the Obama years, people often said, how come you guys aren't doing more to have these discussions with the Taliban? And it's because our principle was always that it has to involve the Afghan government. We weren't willing to cut out the elected government. And keep in mind, they were democratically elected. You can call them corrupt, you can call them all these things. They were democratically elected by a lot of Afghans who turned out to vote in difficult circumstances. And to cut them out of a deal like that was pretty extraordinary. I will say another thing that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. I'm not sure why the Biden people kept on Zal Khalilzad, the envoy who cut the deal with Pompeo. Yeah, like, he's not exactly covered in glory here either, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably just continuity. It's probably easier knowing the writing was on the wall. I mean, yeah, but it's a fair point. So, look, let's talk about the history of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan the last two decades and that mission creep over time, because, you know, this is not just a Trump and Biden story. So the U.S. went to war in Afghanistan in early October of 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks. And by early December, The military effort had been so successful that the Taliban offered to surrender, hand over their weapons, and join the political process as long as Mullah Omar, who was the Taliban leader at the time, could live in Kandahar under house arrest. Bush, Don Rumsfeld, they rejected that deal.
It was the deal that was on the table
in 2019. Yeah. And then that mission quickly shifted from counterterrorism to this broader nation-building exercise. You had Bush, who ran against nation building, talking about a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. This is what he wrote about Afghanistan in his memoir, Ben. Quote, Afghanistan was the ultimate nation building exercise. We had liberated the country from a primitive dictatorship, and we had a moral obligation to leave behind something better. We also had a strategic interest in helping the Afghan people build a free society, end quote. So, of course, as we all know, Bush then invaded Iraq. And for the rest of the administration, you know, Afghanistan was on the back burner. Obama runs on refocusing on the war in Afghanistan. We sent tens of thousands of additional troops to Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010. In hindsight, I think we both have said that was a mistake because it kind of got us back to the status quo ante. But the thinking at the time was, as we were just talking about, happened recently, like major population centers were close to getting overrun by the Taliban. They needed reinforcements. The military mantra was more troops, more time, build the capacity, right? Like, when we began this big offensive in 2010 in a place called Marja, the military said, we're going to come in, we're going to clear out the bad guys, we're going to hold the territory, and we're going to open up government in a box. That was the proposal, the plan. And that part never delivered. We were never able to clear, hold, and then transfer responsibility. And, you know, like, we had a Pentagon coming in from the Iraq surge. And I think we're eager, people like Dave Petraeus were eager to try out that counterinsurgency strategy that they think succeeded in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And so I like, again, like, victory has a thousand fathers and, you know, loss is an orphan. But I do think, like, all these administrations were a part of allowing this mission to balloon over time. And I guess my question is, how do you think it never got right-sized? Because I know Obama was asking a lot of these questions in that 2009 Afghan review, right? Like, what's our real objective? Is it to defeat the Taliban? No. Remember, we had to walk that back in the media, and it was like a big deal with the Pentagon?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, first of all, the original sin here, from which maybe we could have never recovered, is George Bush goes into Afghanistan. And again, I think you and I would have thought at the time, Tommy, as just, you know, people watching the news at that time, that that we were going there to get the people who did 9/11.
Yeah.
And then leave. Like, did anybody think that we were going there to nation build, you know, for even one decade? And so the mission goes so well. I think there was such a moment of triumph and hubris. And the world, those out there who are not quite as middle-aged as we are, like, remember that moment of, like, euphoria, like, America can do anything. We knocked over the Taliban in, like, a matter of weeks. You know, we're going to rout these guys. And then we were installing Hamid Karzai as president. He's getting built up as this kind of George Washington type figure.
Yeah.
And suddenly it became about nation building quickly. And having made that decision, right, to nation build, to then pivot and invade and occupy Iraq and throw far more resources at that, that's the original sin here. Like that, we never recovered from that. If we were going to nation build in Afghanistan, like, you don't need to be like a grand military strategist to know that if you're commencing a nation building project in a place as distant and different from us as Afghanistan, which may never succeed to begin with, but the last thing you want to do is go invade another country.
A place known as the graveyard of empires.
Yeah.
The Russians, like, there are a lot of countries have attempted to nation build in Afghanistan and have failed catastrophically.
So that to me is like, that was always, you know, that's in the grand scheme of the 20 years, the decision to nation build and then invade Iraq stands out to me
as
the one that is kind of irredeemable. Okay, the Obama years, because by the time we come in 2009, and sometimes we should be very clear, like, sometimes people act like we were, like, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Like, you and I were communications officials.
I was some little shit.
But yeah, let's be honest
in the back
here, right?
Of the room. Yeah.
So, and I'm not saying to absolve myself of responsibility. I do just, like, some context matters, and context is also, like, I was basically the speechwriter and you were the spokesperson at the time. We come in and the Taliban is making gains, and Al-Qaeda had really reconstituted itself. particularly in that border region, you know, on the Pakistani side of the border. But Afghanistan was kind of both a place where they could reconstitute and a platform for going after al-Qaeda. Our mistake, I believe, was a surge, right? In the sense that Obama does this review. In the review, he determines, hey, I don't think we can defeat the Taliban. Like, mm-hmm. They're here. They have indigenous support. They're resilient insurgency. We do have an interest in defeating al-Qaeda. And the military's objective through its counterinsurgency strategy, the logic of a counterinsurgency strategy, was to defeat the Taliban.
Yep.
I mean, it was to kind of go district by district in Afghanistan, beat the Taliban, build security forces. And it was an incredibly expansive project that would have been far more expensive than even what we ended up doing.
Help farmers switch from poppy to
wheat. Yeah, grow crops.
It would have been,
you know, over 100,000 U.S. troops there for like a decade, right? And that's what they believe.
And that might not have been enough.
And so then the middle ground that was found was Obama said, like, how long do I need to buy some time and space to take out al-Qaeda? And that becomes, you know, essentially a year and a half. And actually, if you look at the timeline, what's pretty remarkable about the timeline Obama said is that's basically what happened. In that year and a half, we degraded al-Qaeda and we killed Osama bin Laden, right? And so then a second question becomes, why did we stay after killing Osama bin Laden and degrading al-Qaeda? And by that point, it was, you know, we were so invested in this project that, you know, we drew down, but we obviously kept a significant amount of forces in there. But so the Obama challenge was getting kind of caught in between going all in with a counterinsurgency strategy that, by the way, was completely politically unsustainable. There's no way Congress and the American people would have supported like an open-ended counterinsurgency campaign in Afghanistan for another 10 years or just pulling up stakes. And what Obama did is he gradually drew down and gradually, you know, trained Afghan security forces. We got down to, by the end of the Obama administration, there's roughly 10,000 troops there and very few American casualties because the Afghan forces are taking the casualties. They are in the lead with our support. And he had meetings where it was discussed, do we take everybody out? And I was in some of those meetings. And the analysis he got was basically—
that this would happen.
That this would happen.
Right.
And Obama said, I can't, on my way out the door, basically leave a collapsed country to the next president. So I'm going to stop this drawdown at 10,000. And allow the next president to make this decision, which I think that is like defensible in the sense of like, imagine on the way out the door, just creating this circumstance. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the question on whether Obama should have gotten all troops out earlier is tied up in the surge and whether there could have been a quicker drawdown. So, that sounded like a long answer. That's like just skimming the surface of 8 years of Obama and 7 years of George Bush.
Well, and just thinking back to 2009, I mean, like, it did feel at the time like the threat from al-Qaeda was growing.
It was.
Right? Because
we had
a plot, the very scary plot around Obama's inaugural that luckily didn't turn into anything. But, you know, the Christmas Day bomber, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, like we were... If he had done a better job of executing his mission, he would have taken down a passenger jet over Detroit. There was a Times Square bomber that emanated, out of Pakistan.
Yeah.
There were AQAP. There were threats out of Yemen, right? And I'm not, obviously you don't send more troops to Afghanistan to solve a problem in Yemen. I'm not suggesting otherwise. I'm just talking about like the broader context that like the war on terror, fear and mentality and risk that we were all hearing about in intelligence from terrorism was pretty high.
And here's the central tension in the whole deal, right, that came to the forefront 20 years later this week. There were always kind of two wars. There was the war against terrorists, and then there was like the war against the Taliban.
Right.
And the war to kind of build a nation building,
domestic.
And actually, the United States, and Biden said this in remarks, executed the war against al-Qaeda very well and achieved big successes there. And I believe, even as someone who, if you listen, you know, pretty progressive guy here, thinks that the excesses of the war on terror have been a total and utter effing catastrophe. It was the case that, you know, at least from what I saw when I came in 2009, that was a very real terrorist threat. Like, there was a reconstituted al-Qaeda core that was plotting attacks. And so that counterterrorism piece, you know, went forward. At the same time, like, there was this disconnect between, is the other war something that we have to defeat and eradicate the Taliban, or try to stay forever? Like, this is, you know, going to become like a South Korea kind of situation where we have tens of thousands of troops there indefinitely. Or is this a situation where we're just trying to get out as responsibly as we can by? And so what was decided is, no, this is the latter. We have to get out as responsibly as we can. And that becomes an effort to train the Afghan security forces. And you know, obviously that effort did not succeed.
So a couple more things. So I think everyone's trying to figure out now, what will a Taliban government look like? I think recent history doesn't paint a hopeful picture. So when the Taliban was in charge of Afghanistan back in the late 90s, you know, and the judicial system was based on a pretty strict interpretation of Sharia law. Women's rights were severely curtailed. They were forced to wear burqas. They weren't allowed to go out unaccompanied. Women couldn't go to school. There were rampant human rights abuses. Religious minorities, particularly Shia Muslims, were targeted, attacked, assassinated. There's been some reporting, speculation about the current Taliban leadership structure. Ben, it was not heartening to see Sirajuddin Haqqani as the deputy leader, one of the heads of the Haqqani group, one of the more, you know, vicious, brutal terrorist factions in the country. So, you know, it's probably too early to speculate about what the Taliban government might look like. But I mean, how do you expect the international community will or will not interact with them? Because you're already hearing about meetings with Russians, maybe meetings with the Chinese, what the U.S. might do, what presence we'll keep, whether they'll have a rep at the U.N., right? I mean, all these questions are getting asked because kind of have to.
So, I mean, first of all, the Taliban has clearly gotten better at its media strategy, but yeah. I don't have any confidence.
They did a press conference today.
Yeah, then they did an interview with like a woman journalist from Tolo News, the main Afghan news outlet there. I still think that the true colors of the Taliban are brutal and that they will repress women, and they, you know, it may not be as performative as it was at its pre 9/11 height when they've got Bin Laden there and they're executing people in soccer stadiums, but it's going to be brutal. It's going to be a very grim circumstance. Here's the dilemma. They're going to get some recognition, right? You've already seen that the Russians didn't evacuate anybody from their embassy. Like, you know, the Chinese hosted a Taliban delegation recently. Like, Iran, which has tensions with the Taliban for a lot of reasons, but Iran's going to engage them as a neighbor. Pakistan, you know, hasn't said they're going to wait on recognizing, but Pakistan hosted these guys for a long time. So they're going to get, that's going to happen. I think the real challenge for the U.S. and other countries is, on the one hand, you don't necessarily want to recognize and legitimize what could be a truly brutal and repressive government. On the other hand, what you're seeing now is just having a lot of attention on this does have some moderating influence. So I think the policy dilemma is life marginally better for Afghans if we recognize the Taliban and, you know, have an embassy there and just trying to have more countries pressing them to be less horrible? Or is it better served to not recognize them because of the nature of who they are? I don't know the answer to that question. Here's what I do know. One of the consistent policy failures in Afghanistan is our failure to listen to Afghans. You know, and this is a critique I apply across American foreign policy. Like, we've been in Afghanistan for 40 years, basically, if you count the fact that we basically created the Mujahideen, who evolved into the Taliban in the Reagan years when we were using them to fight the Soviets. And at no time, like, we always look at this place just through the prism of whatever the present day political context is in the United States. Like we need to be, and there's another reason why you want a big Afghan diaspora, another reason why you want a lot of these people to get out. Let's listen to them. Let's listen to them about how to think about the Taliban and how to think about these questions. Because, again, I think too often we've been trying to impose solutions on Afghanistan, a place that we clearly don't understand, no matter how long you work on this issue from Washington. And so I think we're going to have to be informed by that viewpoint as well.
Yeah. So the last thing I want to talk about is the politics, because, you know, the situation, what's happening over there is far more important. But it's also been, it's very annoying over the last few days hearing cable news pundits say, oh, Americans don't care about foreign policy. It's not clear if this will impact them.
Total self-fulfilling prophecy
And it's also, it's true until it isn't, right? Americans didn't care about foreign policy until 9/11 happened. And then it drove every election for several cycles.
Yeah.
So, you know, over the years, polling has found a pretty big majority of Americans wanted to get out of Afghanistan. Politico and Morning Consult did a poll that came out on Monday that said that might be changing quickly. They polled from Friday to Monday and found that support for withdrawal had gone from 69% in April to 49% now. So if that's accurate, and there's reasons to doubt all these polls, but that'd be a big shift. But I also wonder if, you know, support or oppose being in Afghanistan or support or oppose withdrawing from Afghanistan is the right question, because sometimes the feeling, the sentiment is just more basic. Like, it can be Americans don't like losing. They don't like hearing that the U.S. has been humiliated, which is literally the language you're hearing from like New York Times straight news copy, right? Like, America's humiliated, Biden humiliated. Like, that is the language. It's about pride. And, you know, like, you also, you don't know what'll happen if there are these horrifying images out of Afghanistan, like we saw in the late 90s, or if there's reports that, you know, Al-Qaeda is gaining strength, right? There's all these ways this could cut. So it's obviously too early to know what the politics will be. But I do think it's worth talking about it, because this fear of terrorism and the insanity with which we have put resources behind preventing terrorism while like 600,000 people die from COVID, right? It's obvious. Like, it's obviously a mismatch. It's imbalance. But those terrible policy choices are driven by these perverse post 9/11 political incentives. And like, we need to fix it. And I don't really know how. And this week is not giving me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I'd say two things about this. I think the first thing is there's a kind of dumbness to how, you know, this gets stuffed into some narrative that can be digested by like a certain vein of DC political commentary. So like this whole Saigon thing, right? This is a lot like Vietnam in the sense that like we should have learned after Vietnam that we shouldn't fight wars like this in countries that we don't understand, where our hubris leads us to make huge mistakes. Like, that's the commonality. Like, I don't think Gerald Ford, like, something has changed in the Washington, D.C. kind of political class. Like, it's not my understanding that, like, when the helicopters took off and you had those images, it was like, what does this mean for Gerald Ford? It was like, what does this mean for the decades we spent in Vietnam, you know? And so there's this kind of oversimplification of things that misses the bigger point, which is that we shouldn't fight wars like this. And you know, how many times do we have to learn that? There's even something, you know, Vietnam syndrome, which became this kind of DC foreign policy and media framework that suggested that it was bad that we had learned from Vietnam that we shouldn't fight wars and we had to get over Vietnam syndrome. Like, no, I hope we get back to having Vietnam syndrome or whatever syndrome you want to call it. So that's about the lesson taken from this. There's such short-termism about like, is the lesson that Biden had a bad week, you know?
Or the optics debate.
Like, or the optics debate.
Why is he alone at Camp David? Why didn't he speak on Sunday versus Monday? It's like, what are we talking
about? No, why does the United States of America have a foreign policy that has repeatedly led it to engage in wars in countries that we don't understand, that morph into nation-building exercises that fail? Like, that's like the real lesson here. But then on the politics, I think... part of the challenge is that the Biden team thus far has been, you know, very good at implementing their agenda, but you're never going to have to manage crises. Those crises, you know, sometimes they're beyond your control. This one, they obviously had some say in because they chose to withdraw. But what the Republicans do is they package together very effectively any bad thing that happens overseas with these kind of this new brand of identity politics where it's like immigration, the border. For us, like it was 2014 and it was like, if you asked Americans, do you care about like the annexation of Crimea and the civil war in Syria, they would say that they didn't. But the Republicans packaged together, well, there's kind of chaos in Syria and it looks like we're feckless in dealing with that. And Putin is, you know, done something in Crimea, a place that most Americans haven't heard of, but that is an embarrassment for us. That there are unaccompanied children coming to the border. There's Ebola and that comes from Africa. So that kind of became a part of this big mm-hmm. other. The Republicans roll all this stuff up into a ball of fear and a sense of American decline and just ram it down Democrats' throats. And so to me, it's not a question of whether Afghanistan will be on the brain of every midterm election voter. The question is whether, you know, it becomes, you know, a part of a broader narrative they build of a Biden team that is lacking in competence and there's chaos and there's scary stuff happening and we can't control it. And you know, and look, there's some foreign policy storm clouds on the horizon. Like these Iran talks are collapsing. Like what happens if Iran starts advancing its nuclear program? There'll surely be another international crisis. And the irony is when international crises happened under Trump, like nobody expected him to solve them. So he like weirdly didn't get blamed.
Right.
He didn't,
like, know? For example, right. Like this evacuation or special immigrant visa issue wouldn't have been an issue under Trump because he just doesn't care.
Yeah. He's nobody expects callous. Him to care. Nobody so, expects him to care.
You know, but Biden gets extra scrutiny for trying as he should.
Democrats you know? Always, right. I mean, like, this used to bother me under Obama. Like the people knew Obama cared about like drone strikes, right? Which again, we talked a lot about on the show, but did anybody ever ask Donald Trump what he was doing to prevent civilian casualties and drone strikes? No, they just knew that Obama was probably plagued by it because he was. And again, that's fair. I'm glad. I'm not complaining about the scrutiny of Obama. I'm complaining about the lack of scrutiny of bad faith critics. You know, but to me, I don't know what you think. Like to me, the political fallout seems like it's more about how does this connect to other things that are happening around the world or other impressions that the Republicans trying to make of Biden.
Yeah. I mean, I think the brass tacks is who knows what people will be thinking about, caring about in 6 months. I do think my concern for the Biden team was, you know, the last few days have looked bad, but depending on how things go in the next week or two or three, it could end up looking even worse. And so they just got to get a handle on it really fast and get people out really fast.
To me, this is the number one thing is like if they can get tens of thousands of Afghans out and salvage something there and look like they did something that was morally correct and effectively managed, that can change a lot of this impression. So the next few weeks, they should get it done. Because if they can't, if they don't get those people out and if they're still talking about a few thousand people out and then Afghans start to get killed, and those we will learn about that, right? That's a different order of magnitude.
And you're going to hear the veterans community. I mean, they're already unbelievably upset about seeing people that worked with them, interpreters, yeah. et cetera. But if things get even worse for those interpreters, you're going to see them speaking up and be incredibly vocal.
I mean, and there's something, because like, look, I appreciate that Biden was very clear of like, I don't regret this decision because I think it's right for America and here's why. I think the two things missing, again, to end where we started, was the lack of empathy for the Afghans and the lack of kind of acknowledgement that there are things that we're watching that should be done better.
From a guy who is known for his empathy. I mean, yeah. We watched human beings fall from the wheel well of a fucking C-17.
Yeah.
I will never forget that image for as long as I live. Yeah. Obviously, like, I'm not saying that was Joe Biden's fault, but like, part of your job as president is to speak to how people felt seeing that or the humanity of the individual who fell off that plane.
And to have empathy for other people around the world, I mean, and there's something I've been thinking about, Tommy, a little bit too, because I remember, you know, you can be guilty in the White House sometimes when you're so bombarded with criticism, you weirdly take that as like validation that you've done something brave and right, you know? Sometimes you have to listen to the criticism, you know? And it doesn't mean you have to question your core decision, right? And this is kind of part of what we went through, say, and you were gone by the time with the red line thing where they need to show that they've learned something from this, I think. And I say that with humility and sympathy. I say that as someone who made that mistake myself. So I'm just trying to learn from my own experience that I think people will respect and appreciate it if, number one, they really, move heaven and earth and take on some risks to get Afghans out in the next few weeks. And number two, that there's kind of a bit of a demonstration that, like, okay, we 100% stand by this withdrawal decision, but we understood and we did some things wrong and we're going to, evolve to do better.
Yeah, and they're going to keep making that point that Jake made, that the U.S. staying in Afghanistan or sending more troops and continuing to fight in the middle of a civil war has a cost for the United States, but has an even greater cost for the Afghan people, especially civilians who are caught up in that fighting and killed. So they're going to have to make that case, but also just have to recognize, like, the recency bias of the images we're seeing, one, and the fact that a lot of members of the media worked with Afghans, interpreters, drivers, fixers, whatever, who they know personally and are trying to help get out. And, like, that humanity, that personal connection is going to drive some of the coverage and drive some of the moral outrage that you're hearing on TV, like, fair or not, right? And, like, yeah. So they're going to have to speak to both of these challenges. And, like, there's no good option. There was no good option here for Joe Biden in Afghanistan. The table was set for him.
Yeah.
But he could have executed a withdrawal better, and that's just a fact.
And one thing we can talk about in future episodes, like, I think around the world, people, like, from what I hear in Europe, it's like uniformly, like, Biden is no different than Trump. Like, he doesn't care about people outside of America. It's America first. There's a way to talk about that. I'll be specific about what I mean about evolving. And it's a messaging point, but that's, like, a lot of what I focused on. He also said something towards the end of his speech about, like, how human rights is the cornerstone of our foreign policy. And I think that clanged with a lot of people, because it's like, you just kind of didn't empathize with these Afghans. You can't just assert then. But if he'd said, like, I want human rights to be the center of our policy, and I understand that people might be questioning that now, watching what happened in Afghanistan, but I believe that ultimately the way to put human rights back at the center of our foreign policy is not by continuing to fight wars, but we want to part of our commitment to human rights is getting as many of these people out and learning from this experience to get better. You know, like,
yes.
There's a way to talk about these things so that you don't sound like you haven't absorbed that we've taken a hit here, what you want to suggest is, no, we understand that and we're going to try to get better.
Yeah. And then just, we need to end forever the suggestion, argument, op-ed that says that the U.S. can advance a human rights agenda with the military.
By fighting a war. I mean, that, like,
it hasn't
Biden
worked.
Can get the high ground on this in some ways, like, the 100%.
It's just, I can't believe that lesson needs to be relearned.
I can't believe. I mean, it is astonishing to me that some of the, there's people I haven't even heard from, like Paul Wolfowitz is coming out of the fucking woodwork, right? These people, because again, honestly, like, even to be fair to the Trump people, right? This was basically all set in motion. Afghanistan, Iraq, post 9/11, torture, Guantanamo, all this stuff in like a few months. I mean, ICE was created in the post 9/11 reforms. Like, all of these excesses that we've lived through were shaped by a pretty small number of people in the George W. Bush administration. And they're still, like, held up as these authorities on foreign policy. I mean, what the fuck? You know,
I probably would have rejected the Paul Wolf.
I get more shit from these people, but this is insane that these people are still, like, just walking around as if they're authorities on anything.
Wolfowitz, Bremer, get the band
even
back
like
together.
But even like Cheney. Condi Rice, she's a national security advisor. Anyway,
now you're just ranting.
Now
you're just talking your mentions.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay. We're all there. Anything else we should talk about?
No, I mean, unfortunately, I think we'll be talking about this Afghanistan situation, going forward. So
yeah, and just so folks know, I mean, what I think going forward we'd like to do is obviously get some Afghan voices on the show.
Yeah.
We try to get someone in Kabul today who understandably had a lot going on and couldn't make it.
Yeah.
We also wanted to reach out to the administration to see if they wanted to talk more about this. So those are some of the things we're thinking about for this topic going forward. But yeah, it's
and the Europe. I think it'd be important. Keep in mind NATO was with us. A lot of allies were with us. So it'd be good. We'll be looking at, I think, how is this being digested in NATO and European countries, and not the lazy like America has no credibility anymore take, but the more like, okay, what's next for us?
The like,
Taiwan is going to surrender, right? You know,
like, the take I have no time for is like, the rest of the world now believes the U.S. won't follow through on its commitments or doesn't understand foreign policy. It's like, they've seen Vietnam, they've seen Iraq, they know they watch the Trump administration. I think the rest of the world is pretty well conditioned to realize that sometimes the United States makes horrifying mistakes or goes insane and elects reality show demagogues. Like, I refuse to believe the rest of the world is like all that surprised right now when we make a mistake broadly. It's like not about our reputation or our standing, it's about Afghanistan in a poor execution of a withdrawal. That I'll accept.
And look, you know, like not succeeding in multi-decade nation-building efforts is not the same as whether or not we'd come to the defense of a NATO ally. Like, this is a different question.
Right.
And also, like, to these people, like, this is America's lost its credibility. Like, I think that was pretty much, that horse was out of the barn with the fucking election of Donald Trump. So,
the insurrection probably didn't help either.
The thoughtful, like, you know, chin scratching takes about America losing its credibility in Afghanistan. I don't know. I guess I could argue that maybe the invasion of Iraq played a role in that. Maybe the financial crisis did. And whatever credibility was left, I'd like to think was pretty much gone by the time that Donald Trump is president of the United States.
But by all means, get three people at a European think tank to say that America won't fall through.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, I think that's it for us for this week.
Yes. Yes.
This was helpful for me. Good deep dive.
Yeah. Sorry to go on, but I think hard to do in 240 characters here.
Yeah, man. Well, we'll talk to you guys next week. And I don't know. Share the episode if you like it. Rate, review. We're trying to talk about this in an honest way that includes a lot of self-criticism. But let us know if we didn't do well. Something like that.
Yeah, self-criticism is always something that people want until you do it. And then it's like, oh, great. And like, let's criticize some more, you know?
Yep. Well, that's the job.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Talk to you next week.
See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Yale Fried, and Phoebe Bradford, who film and share our episodes as videos each week.